It is a delight to be with you all again this afternoon. I said this morning that like every other church in the New Testament, and I suppose any other church that has people in it, the church of Corinth had problems with it. Real problems. In fact, I've been a minister in their right mind that they're going to trade their church for Corinth. Corinth had some very serious problems. It had to do with things that if you want to read about some of the details, start with chapter 5, and you'll know what I'm talking about. Paul deals with it and other issues, and Paul doesn't start dealing with these issues at first. He knew before he had to address another matter. And that is that we spoke a little bit about this morning. There are factions that were forming. Some were saying, I belong to Paul, others, I belong to Apollos, and others to Cephas. And Paul is concerned that members of the Church of Corinth have become preoccupied with personalities. They've been carried away with hero worship, personality cults, with thinking about the personal traits, qualities, characteristics, strengths, weaknesses of various individual teachers that they have had. Instead of that which is far more important to their existence, far more determinative of whether or not they will survive the test. So beyond the assumptions about ministry that he discusses in chapter 2, which we did a bit this morning, Paul elaborates here in chapter 3 his understanding of ministry further. And the first thing he says is Paul affirms that God uses different types of individuals to do different types of tasks. He acknowledges that personalities are unavoidable because individuals don't come without personalities. Apollos had his, Paul had his, yet Paul says, so what? So what about us as individuals? So what about our personalities? Are we not really men, he says? What then is Apollos? What then is Paul? Servants through whom we believe and as the Lord assigned to each. Sure, we got our personalities, our likes and dislikes, but what are these? What difference does this really make in light of what we have been called to be and to do? In light of Him about whom we have been called to speak and about whom we have been called to live, for whom we've been called to live. Second, Paul recognizes the value of different gifts that are used to do different tasks. He says, I planted, Apollos watered, but God gave the growth. Paul acknowledges the plurality of gifts and the tasks of planting and watering. But isn't it interesting that Paul acknowledges the value of each of these tasks without asserting that his planting was more important? I mean, he could have said, well, yes, Paul, he did some watering, but I did the really important thing, the planting. He doesn't do that. He acknowledges the importance of each. Thirdly, Paul acknowledges the planting, the watering, and the growth are all part of the process. Ministry is always a process, an ongoing process that never finishes. If some of you have been teachers, and you know when you finish a semester, you grade your papers, you turn in your grades, you walk at graduation, more or less you've done for a little while. Ministry's not like that. Ministry is this ongoing process, always planting and watering. But the most important thing is that God gives the growth. And He gets the credit. It belongs to Him and not to us. Yet there's something else Paul assumes about ministry that he's obviously quite concerned to make clear. He wants to make clear that every minister, sooner or later, every ministry and minister will be tested. He says, for the day will disclose it. And his reference here to the day is from Jewish apocalyptic, Jewish apocalyptic term that Jesus also used. And it refers to God's judgment, which comes not merely as if you know your Jewish apocalyptic literature. You know that the day means not just some day in the sky by and by, but something is ongoing. something that happens here and now, and not just then and there, later. And notice Paul does not say the day may close it at some point. He said the day will disclose it. In other words, the work of every ministry, as well as every minister, which includes every one of us, sooner or later will be faced with the judgment of God. And by the way, this is why churches have installation services and ordination services. Because when the testing comes, ministers are often tempted to run away. And so they want to get time to take your vows or reaffirm your vows. You got to lash them to the mast. Same thing for marriage. You wouldn't need people to make vows unless, well, we won't get into that this morning. Paul's point is that every minister, and every ministry, sooner or later will be tested. Therefore, he says, and he changes his analogy here from the garden to a building, let each man take care how he builds, for no other foundation can anyone lay than that which is laid, which is Jesus Christ. Now, if anyone builds on that foundation with gold, silver, precious stones, wood, hay, straw, each man's work will be manifest again, for the day will disclose it, because it will be revealed with fire. And the fire will test what sort of work each has done. I don't know about you, but I've had reason to think a bit about these verses lately. When I think of all that's happened in the church in this country over the last several decades, and not least of all to the Presbyterian Church, for the last 50 years, some of us were talking about this just a few moments ago. When I think about my own father, 40 years in ministry, I think about all the blood, sweat, and tears that he and his friends put into serving the church. When I think of all the blood, sweat, and tears so many of us, others of us I know, who have put into serving the church, I have wondered about this passage, ruminating on this passage, when I think about the fact that our own church has lost 2/3 of its membership in the last 50 years. I have been thinking about these verses. Perhaps you have too. Of course, Presbyterians aren't the only group of Christians in this country who are struggling. I don't know any that aren't struggling in one way or another. Independent denominations, non-denominations, sub-denominations, mainlines, sidelines, they're all struggling in one way or another. And in different ways. Some more than others. And the crumbling of so many Christian organizations and institutions in recent years has caused many leaders I know to wonder about what will last? Because a lot seems to have been burned up lately. Have you wondered about this as well? Have you not wondered whether the day Paul is talking about has come and the quality of the work that has been done in the past is now being disclosed, revealed? It's causing many to wonder about the kind of materials that they and we have built with in the past. We may not all admit it publicly, but many of us ask, did we use quality materials, such as gold and silver and precious stones, as Paul talks about here? Or did some of us use inferior qualities, products such as wood or hay or stubble, as he refers to? I know this is a wonderful celebration, but you know what? It's good for us to be sober about this, too. The challenges are great. And it is simply not true, and it's a lame excuse to suggest that the reason for our difficulties is because Christianity is not growing. The fact is, Christianity, despite what you may read in the newspaper or hear on television, is experiencing right now an explosive period of growth. In fact, we are today living in the middle of the greatest explosion of Christianity in the history of the church. Some of you may be aware of it, maybe others maybe not, but it is clear that one of the most important social, political, and demographic developments in the 20th century was not the fall of fascism or communism or the rise of democracy, but the explosive growth of the Christian church in the southern hemisphere of this globe, in Asia, in Africa, in South and Central America. Did you know that today there are more Presbyterians in Kenya alone than in the United States? There are more Presbyterians in Korea, you surely know this, than in the United States. Did you know that in the year 1900, there were only 10 million Christians in Africa? But today, or in 2000, there were over 630 million Christians in Africa. And did you know that in 2000, there were 480 million Christians in Asia? And it is estimated that Europe still claims the highest number of Christians than any other continent. But in 2025, it is projected that Europe will be either third or fourth in numbers, behind Africa, Asia, and Latin America. God has done a wonderful and is doing wondrous things in His church in our time. And if you're interested to know a little more about it, a good place to begin with a book called The Next Christendom by Philip Jenkins, Oxford Press, 2011. But of course, all these young churches around the world, just like the church at Corinth and just as we are facing today, will too, sooner or later, be tested. And the question they will face, just as we must face, is what sort of materials have we used or are using in seeking to build up the church? Are we using cheap, second-rate materials that will not endure tests, such as wood, hay, and straw? Or are we using quality materials, such as gold and silver, and precious stones? And of course, Paul isn't using these various sorts of materials as an analogy, in a complex analogy. He isn't talking about physical structures. There were no physical structures called churches in Paul's day. Paul is clearly making some sort of analogy here, but he's using it to describe the various ways people do things in the church. He's talking about the various methods, the tactics, the strategies that people use in trying to build up the church. And he wants to distinguish between two different types. Those that are based on what he calls the wisdom of this world, and others that are appropriate, fitting, in accord with the church's one true foundation, which is Jesus Christ. The reason I say this is because of what Paul says in verse 17. He says, "For God's temple is holy, and that temple you are. Let no one deceive himself. If anyone among you thinks that he is wise in this age, let him become a fool, that he may become wise. For the wisdom of this world is folly, so let no one deceive you." Paul's concern with this. Some at Corinth want to apply the wisdom of the world when it comes to building and growing the church. They seem to think it's primarily about finding the right person with the right personality. Perhaps they've been saying, you know, what we need around here is a real go-getter, a real charismatic type of guy who can win lots of friends and influence people with his charm and winning personality, just like he did well in business or in politics. And Paul says, not so fast, friends. Not so fast. A ministry that is built to last is not built upon any one man or woman, upon his or her gifts, skills, or personal characteristics. That may work, and it may appear clever and sufficient in the world, but that won't cut it in the church. Well, it may seem to work for a while, but it doesn't usually last because it can't stand the test. Now, to be sure, the wisdom of the world has its place. Don't get me wrong. And most churches I know could use more of it than they realize about all sorts of things. If you've got any to spare, I'm sure there's people around here who would like to know about it. Worldly wisdom is a very bad. I had an operation not too long ago, and I thank God for the worldly wisdom of that surgeon. Oh, my. Worldly wisdom, I'm all for that. But when it comes to ministry, the Bible teaches us repeatedly to be wary. Jesus says the children of this world are wiser in their generation than the children of God. And again, please don't misunderstand me. Paul isn't saying we shouldn't strive to bring our best human skills and human talents to the work of the church. Nor is he pleased, actually, with those who don't. Notice what he says in verses 10 and 11. He says, according to the grace of God given to me, like a master builder, I lay a foundation, and someone else is building on it. Let each one take care of how he builds. Paul strives for excellence. And he obviously isn't happy about people doing shoddy work or bringing inferior materials to the task of building the church. But he adds this, and this is the key to the whole passage. For no other foundation can anyone lay than that which is laid, which is Jesus Christ. Paul speaks here of having assumed the role of a master builder, which I take to mean that he must have put a great deal of thought and effort in what he was doing. Yet he was inspired, but he also aspired to bring his best work, his best skills, his best thoughts, his best creativity and imagination to this work of building up the church. Why? Because of the supreme quality, the supreme beauty and majesty of the foundation. The foundation which is laid is Christ, he said. Paul had a sense of the supreme beauty and majesty of the body of Christ that God was building up, and it motivated him to give his best. I find this instructive. Most churches in this country, and not least of all us Presbyterians, of all stripes, even, are going through a time of testing. Much has been burned away, and we've been finding out that some of the methods, strategies, tactics haven't worked. There have been inferior quality and can't withstand the test. So we are called to discern the differences between the wood and the hay and the straw and the gold and the silver and the precious stone when it comes to the task of ministry. We're called to discern what will really last. And we're called to bring our best skills, our best talents, thoughts, efforts. And if I may offer a personal word, you're getting ready to install a minister who has enormous gifts, training, skills, and experience. He knows the difference between wood, hay, and straw versus gold, silver, and precious stones better than any minister I know in this denomination or any denomination. Yeah, sure, I know that people don't know how much, they don't care how much you know until they know that you care. I believe that. But I doubt you want a minister who cares a lot but doesn't know much either. Any more than you want a doctor who cares so much but doesn't know anything. Oh, my doctor cares so much. He doesn't really know anything, but he cares so much about it. I haven't heard that. But the Lord has been very good to you, and you have received a great lesson in these two servants, Danielle and Michael, who not only know a great deal, but they also care deeply. And you've received a great gift in them and a great blessing. But may I say that the church in this country is going through a challenging time. And if this congregation is going to withstand the test like all the others, the test of the day that Paul is talking about, it's going to take all of you working together, pulling together, bringing your best work and your best talents and skills. You have a wonderful heritage here. I have found out more about it. I knew something about it. But this congregation has been blessed for 223 years. And it's been blessed not just with pastors, but numbers of wonderful men and women who have loved this church sacrificially with their time and their talent and their treasure and service to this church. You read this book, it's been a great deal to them. It's certainly meant more to them, or at least as much to them, as their hobbies. So I think it's a fair thing to say that if you want this church to stand the test of the day, much less grow and prosper, then this service to this church is going to have to mean at least as much to you as your hobbies. Yet, I hope you don't hear this as another burdensome task, for another chore as yet another obligation in an already busy life filled with too many unmet expectations. I hope you don't hear it. I'd rather you hear it as a gracious invitation, as an opportunity to be part of something bigger, more beautiful, more satisfying, and lasting than any hobby could ever be. It is an invitation to be part of building God's kingdom in this world. It is an opportunity to be used by Him in building an eternal structure, the beauty and glory of which shall never fade. So may the Lord give you and I and us a sense of true joy and satisfaction and a deeper appreciation for the beauty of the structure He is building in this world. And the supreme blessing it is to give Him our best skills, our best talents, our best faults and efforts. And above all, may the Lord give you courage and assure you that the church's one foundation is still Jesus Christ, her Lord. And this foundation is unshakable.
Thank you.
in all places and all times. Christian, what do you believe?
I believe in God.